Well, all right. Happy Thursday. Been a rough week weather-wise. Hopefully everyone is doing fine out there. But let's talk more fishing right now and then some great discussion on Smoke It Up this hour. Mark, what's the I knew that story you wanted to tell?
One of my funniest stories was I knew an outdoor artist, Bill Elliott, and I knew him for a long time. And he was calling me because he knew I caught a lot of big trout. And so he was like, you know, Mark, I've caught 30-pound snook on fly. I've caught, you know, 100-pound tarpon on fly. I've caught giant redfish on fly. I've never caught a big trout on fly. Mm-hmm. And he, like, you know, I was like, Bill, you know, I'm not on like big trout right now. And a lot of that sometimes was my guilt was that I wasn't fishing for big trout because I was having fun fishing for tarpon at the time. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of blowing them off. And finally, like, I'm going, Bill, I'm on a great tarpon buddy. And we went to this place called Five Fingers. We saved half a dozen tarpon roll. He makes a perfect cast into them, instantly hooks up, sets it good, starts fighting the fish, keeps fighting it. It's not coming up. Within about 2 minutes, the fish comes up, and it's a 31-inch trout. You effer. You knew it was here. I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, I knew that.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, hey, yeah. Just take the compliment. You're the expert.
Yeah, not at all where I fish for them at all. So mm-hmm. It's like nothing right about it, but that's a cool thing. You know, that's what keeps it coming back. And these days, watching somebody else catch a big fish for me is the best. You know, I had a buddy of mine, I don't know if I was telling you, Scott, but came down from North Carolina. We took several tarpon, you know, and had some good jumps and had a great time. And we were coming back to the ramp, and I was like, there's a place where I've caught trout, and I've been kind of watching them grow a couple inches a year for the last 3 years. And so I wanted to go catch some. And so he brought out his rod from North Carolina, 10-pound braid and 16-pound leader. So we go over by a dock, and he throws one of our 4-inch cow jerk baits, golden brim. It's a really good color. And he twists it a couple times, hooks a fish. Fish takes off. I'm like, you just hooked a big snook. And it swims around a piling. And it's taking a lot of line, and it's still going. And I'm like, don't pull hard. We'll go around the piling and see where it's at. Mm-hmm. But as I'm around the piling, I see that he's already at the dock 75 yards away, wrapping around the dock up there, splashing around. I'm going, oh, great, this ain't going to happen. But so as we come around the first piling, his line is still going to the piling. We can't quite figure it out, so he pulls hard, and it must have been on a splinter on the piling. So it comes total slack, so he's pissed because he's lost the fish. So he's cranking fast before he realizes he's still on the fish, but he just had a whole lot of slack line when it came off of the splinter. So now he starts gaining line, and the stupid fish swam back out from the structure, and he landed a 41.5-inch snook on 10-pound braid and 16-pound leader, where it swam around two sets of docks. And, you know, it's the most beautiful fish in the world. I was like, holy cow. It's pretty cool. And it's also cool that I've been fortunate enough to be around here when we could hook a lot of snook. Yeah. And we could go out at night, and we could hook a lot of 10-pound plus fish.
You know, people ask me occasionally this because the business that I'm in, they always ask me, like, who are some celebrities that you've fished with? And, you know, I'll mention a name or two. And can they fish? You know, what was it like? Any stories? Now, you have been on a lot of TV shows, a lot of celebrities, stuff like that. What can you share with that maybe won't embarrass them too much, but maybe embarrass them a little bit?
Well, like, you know, there's some that I just can't say because it would be bad. Lot of outdoor writers writing stories, and I remember taking more than one outdoor writer where after reading the story I was like, was I on that trip? I did what with what? And thinking what? Kind of grin and bear it sometimes. But I've had really funny experiences. You know, I took a guy fishing one time, and he jumped off the boat, and for some reason he slipped and he filled up his waders. And the nicest gentleman in the world, his name was Joe, Cowboy Joe we called him. And mm-hmm. Joe was probably 78, and he was the youngest of three brothers, so he had to do all the work at the deer camp, set it up. I was like, and he walked with a limp like he'd been falling off a horse a few times, but he hops out, he floods his waders, he gets back in the boat. I said, you know, drop your waders off and, you know, pour them out. He laid on his back and lifted his leg straight up. And his comes running out all over him. I was like, well, that's really not the way I was thinking, but
it did the job. So it did the job.
I don't know. I've had a lot of, you know, good, you know, good, funny experiences. You know, I hooked, I don't ever do bait and switches. With the only exception, I've done a couple of bait and switches where I hooked a fish and put a, where they stuck a fly in the fish's mouth. Didn't feel too bad about that. And, both times it was big jacks, you know, like 15 plus pound jacks. And one of them, I stuck the hook in its mouth, let go, and the fish, I had beat it on a 30 pound braid, 60 pound leader, and I didn't give it a prayer. I kicked its ass immediately, got it up to the boat, pulled that lure out, put the hook in its mouth. Fish took off. The TV show host is looking, saying, that's a big, you know what? Yeah. And the rod launches out of his hand as it takes off. There, and I cast over the rod, snag the rod, bring the rod back, and he lands a fish. And I'm going, this is going to be the greatest TV in the world. That's fun shit, you know. And he's like, oh, I wouldn't do that because it would make me look bad. I'm like, are you serious?
Come on. Come on.
And I was like, you missed the best part. This is the real world, dude. I couldn't believe it. It's just bizarre. You know?
We've all thrown at rods. We've all thrown at rods that we've dropped in the water.
We've all done all sorts of stuff that, you know, sometimes, I mean, I'm not too proud to admit it because I hopefully didn't do it six times.
Me and Martin fishing over there, the last time I was there, we got back to the house. He realized he left his shoes at the dock. And they were his old fishing shoes, his favorite old fishing shoes. And he was all, oh, man, I can't believe I left them over there. They're going to be gone. They're gone. And me and him, we had a few drinks, so we didn't want to drive back to the dock. And then I left. And he let me know a few days later that he had gone back over to the dock, and they were still sitting there. Even the homeless guy wouldn't take them.
Yeah. It's nice. Yeah, people have mentioned my smell before, but, you know, they told me to put my shoes outside maybe more than once.
There's a homeless guy that stays there all the time, and that guy wouldn't even take them. It was...
I know. I was surprised. They didn't look that bad.
Hey, so what about, because, you know, our listeners, I'm always trying to think for them and what they're thinking. Man, they must be going, all right, so what is the biggest trout you told us, you know, some of these other memorable fish that to this day, as many as you've caught, whether it's one that maybe you lost and caught again, or you saw and you kept going back and stalking, like, what are the most memorable fish that to this day stand out to you?
In some cases, it's situations. And one situation, specifically talking about trout, I was waiting. One of the bars that I've talked about, I was trying to get a 2-pound record, but I was with my brother one time, and I love my brother. He's the goofiest fisherman in the world, but he's a good guy. And so we were out waiting, and it was one of those evenings where, you know, you're on a pretty light sand bottom. We're very fortunate here where we had a lot of good firm bottom. And, you know, I'm standing in probably calf deep water, and barely a foot deep. And I'm standing there, and all the cars are driving. They all got their headlights on. It's getting pretty dark, but, you know, when your eyes adjust like that, it's pretty, you can still see pretty well. Mm-hmm. And a row of five trout swam by me. All of them were over 30-inch fish. And just before that, a pod of little finger mullet had gone by me, and they were all milling around just about 20 feet away from me. And when those trout went over there, they instantly boxed them into a really tight group. And I had a bait buster on, but I didn't cast for at least 10 minutes. And I just watched them. And they was way too shallow for them to do a topwater strike, but they would rush the baits. And they would take turns rushing the baits. You see the baits come up and get nervous on the surface and go back down. And I've seen that where trout will do that on them, and flounder will do that on them too, pretty regular too. But, you know, I watched them do that several times before I finally had to make a cast. But that night, you know, as I'm getting ready to make a cast, my brother calls me, and he had a 32-inch fish. And so, you know, there were big fish, you know, and it was the right time. And when you're in the right time, the right place, it's really, really cool. And it's really, really cool to watch fish that are literally swimming by you 3 feet away. And you're watching them go in that single file right by you, and you're not moving, just like in a blind or whatever. It was dark enough where if you didn't move, they didn't know you were there.
Yeah.
And that was really cool. I guess I got three stories.
Well, let's get them. You know they're going to be good. That's next, right here on Sports Radio 610. All right, we're back on the Bite Me Fishing Show with Captain Mark Nichols, the legendary one from DOA Lures. Lots of great stuff here, Mark. You said you had stories about the biggest fish you've caught.
I'm with the family, and we're out there, and the water's still pretty chilly, and they're wanting to go snorkeling around, and I don't even have a rod with me, and I go for a walk and start looking on the flats to see if I can see some fish. And I start walking, and I see a snook that's, you know, in the mid-40s, and it's laying in a nice sand hole. And so I don't have a rod with me. Since I don't have a rod with me, I'm just going to sneak up on it. And I literally did, because I didn't have a rod, never blew it with a cast. Yeah. And I literally was on my hands and knees, because the fish was in at the most 18 inches, not even. And it was laying in this pothole, and I got real low, and I started crawling. And at that point, I was probably 10 feet from the fish. She was looking the opposite way. And the tide had switched. And when I kicked up the sand from crawling, she turned 180 degrees. And without me moving, she swam up to me where I could touch her.
Oh, wow.
Scales on her body. And I wasn't moving, and I was wearing a white t-shirt, but I just wasn't, you know, I was total there, you know, and I didn't blow it. And it was freaking awesome to watch that come right up on me like that. And, okay, I got four stories, another one just like that.
Let's go.
We're filming a little TV show for a local show over on the west coast of Florida. And I'm waiting, and again, it's really nice, beautiful water. There's nice grass. I see a snook cruising, like a 10-pound fish. It's beautiful. I make a cast, and the fish turns on me and starts coming right at me. It's like 20 feet away, and by the time I gain my line, it's maybe 10 feet. And I flip a cast like 12 feet and bring it diagonally across its face, and the lure lands on my shoe, and the fish eats it off my shoe.
Get out of here.
It picked up on that lure coming across its eye is just the luckiest time in the world, because it followed that lure all the way down and sucked it in. And I didn't get a good hook set, like pulling straight up like that. I hooked it took off and made a turn, and it spit. And I was like, I called the camera guy. I go, I got a fish. He's coming up on me. Here he comes. And he got the hook set, but damn fish got away.
Off your shoe.
It was really cool. Okay, and here's to me one of the best.
Okay.
I'm wade fishing, and I just make a pinch weight. And we had a really good pompano bite. And we make colored pinch weights, and I can just pinch it right on my shrimp hook. And I had a red one on my shrimp hook. And I'd seen some tarpon, but I couldn't reach them. And I was walking back to where I parked, and a tarpon rolls literally 30 inches in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I open my bail, and as the little pinch weight is dropping, before I feel a fish eat it, I feel the wake of the fish turning across my legs, because I was wearing shorts.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt this wake, and then I felt the thump, and then the fish jumped straight up, and he threw the thing right over my shoulder. I can still get goosebumps, because it was like, you know, literally feeling that wake before I felt the fish eat was, can't even describe it. It was really, really,
something that
really
just struck me on this. You just told your four favorite stories, and not one of them where you landed a fish. That's what's so cool about it.
Yeah, I've caught great fish, but you know, those that haunt you sometimes were just so special. You know.
Yep.
I'm trying to figure out which story I like best. Those are badass. Those are all great.
It's just so lucky, you know, to be out there, and you know, you don't see it by being at home.
No,
you tried for a long time to do that 2-pound record. I know you were, I talked to you off and on when you were doing it. What was the biggest one you got on 2-pound line?
I got like 8 over 9.5, and I got one that was, I swear, dead on 10 pounds. The world record was 10.2. And I swear I probably hooked, I would bet that I had probably 2 or 3 other fish that would have broke it, but I was trying to be some dumbass purist and use a short leader instead of getting a 15-foot leader where I could have put a wrap on my spool.
Yeah. And,
you know, most all those fish were lost when they're right there, because when they're 30 feet away, you got so much stretch in that too that you can get away with. You know, basically, you just kind of fingered the spool.
Yeah.
You know, tension on it. So, you know, I got pretty good at getting them, but when they were in super tight, you know, then it was got really pretty special. But I also used a dish rag. I shoved it in their mouth and they'd snag their teeth really well. And then I could land by lipping them without having to reach in their gills or grab their body.
Yeah.
I was always in the water anyway, so, you know, my fish were never stressed when they were leaving. Mm-hmm. A lot of them had them on too. It was more like you were doing Zen, trying to talk them into you, you know. Right. And,
man.
Oh, that brings me to another story. This is important.
Okay.
All
you want.
There's I've had some really good friends. My coworker Roy is fishing with recently, and we're fishing, and he's a good angler. We're fishing around some structure. He hooked a big snook, and he's fighting. The snook took him under a piling, under a dock, and under two floating docks, and he's trying to play tug of war with that fish, and it will not work. You ain't gonna get that fish back, because he's got too much stuff in between him and you. Mm-hmm. If you open the bail and he feels no resistance, about 80% of the time he swims exactly the way he swam away. Mm-hmm. And he feels no resistance, therefore he's not pulling hard, therefore you're not having any resistance against a barnacle or anything like that. And you gain your line, and a lot of times he swims right out exactly where he ate.
Mm-hmm.
He can load up on him again. Mm-hmm. And I know this because I've lost a shitload of fish until at a certain point in time. You know, that didn't work, let me try something else. And we learned, where we'd have fish that you know is going to wrap you around a piling. You open your bail, and he relaxes. If he doesn't feel any resistance, he doesn't have a reason to pull.
Yeah.
He swims back, gets in line to start to eat again. And then you ready and pull. You know, we used to get together where you'd have the guy hit the trolling motor, and you'd walk to the bow of the boat from the back of the boat at the same time and get him where he would not have a chance to rotate his head sideways.
Well, there's a lesson there, man.
Yeah, that's, you know, this important stuff. Hope everybody's taking notes. You know, with these tarpon fishing, they reopen the nuclear power plant, 11, and those tarpon have been in this place because it's 40 feet deep, and they've got a nice thermocline. There's all kinds of bait in there, and they get real happy. And we've learned that at times you're seeing rolling fish almost all the time there.
Yeah,
and there's days when you can throw at them, and, you know, short of a hand grenade, you ain't even going to get their attention.
Yeah.
We'll change colors, and I have learned that sometimes, you know, I'll go to a color I hate, like a chartreuse or a pink, and they'll eat the darn thing, you know, but generally we're fishing more some of the darker colors. But if I can't get them to eat there, I'm marking them at 30 feet. They're usually 10 feet off the bottom or somewhere around the 20-foot range. If I can drop that bait straight down and not move it, they will eat it.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll hook a half a dozen fish by just, you ideally like just a slight breeze, so they'll just slowly push you across.
Yeah.
You can get it setting at a depth, and, you know, first we prefer to throw at them, but if they're not eating, we've got something just sitting there.
Yeah.
And I think when I was talking to Scott one day, I literally took a quarter ounce terrorize, and then I took one of our floats and I carved it until I got it where it's just subsurface, so it won't go up and down with the ripple in the water, so that when it's floating, it stays straight, not bouncing up and down.
I told you this was going to be good. I told you this was going to be good, people. Man, we could do this all day. I do have one more question for you, because it's one that we've been getting for as long as we've been doing this podcast. How often do you change your lure? How often do you change your plastic? How often this? How often that? Well, let's ask the guy who designs them and is out on the water every day. How often do you change your lures? What goes into that?
Usually it's because I'm getting humbled by somebody who's throwing something I would never throw. A lot of people are getting stuck on something and not changing as much as I should.
Yeah.
And then get slapped in the face by somebody tying something else on and instantly catch a fish. So I definitely believe that there can be a good bit to do with colors. I will always argue that skill is going to outfish unskill, whether they don't have the quote right color or not. But there are times when fish are suicidal over certain colors. When I was out the other day, my buddy that lost that fish I was talking about, I had another friend of mine that does our IT work, brought his son out. Son's an excellent angler. His son hooked a big snook. His son was throwing a pearl terrorized with a green back. Very natural looking color. I hadn't been throwing them. I've been throwing, you know, darker colors.
Yeah.
And he got broke off by two big fish. And he also made the same mistake, and I scolded him too. Felt that fish go right under a piece of steel. Don't pull anymore. You ain't gonna win. Happened. But I'm also gonna, you know, I've got some friends, you know, my Okeechobee buddies, they don't use leader. They'll tie it directly braid right to the lure. And I think sometimes the smaller diameter of the braid, especially in the dark, might create less awareness by a fish as opposed to a larger diameter leader cutting through the water.
Yeah. No, Scott and I have talked about that as well. I go back and forth. It depends on what I'm throwing. I'll tie it straight to the line, man.
And the braid is certainly so much more flexible. Your lure is going to act differently if it's tied directly onto the braid versus a heavier leader.
Absolutely great stuff, man. Appreciate it. Coming up next, it's Smoke It Up. What are the latest trends right now in the barbecue game? What should we do? Welcome back. Smoke It Up right now. You know, we talk a lot of with a lot of pitmasters in this segment. It's this time every week. But this week, we're going to talk about trends we should all know with Wes Wright from Cookout News. It's where the industry gets its news and stays up to date on everything going on in the barbecue game. You are the man. I mean, you are the man when it comes to just being at the tip of the arrow, so to speak. For our listeners' sake, I'm going to introduce you properly, and then we'll get into some topics here that I think really all of our listeners are going to be very, very excited and interested in listening. Wes Wright, Cookout News. And I'm going to let you take it from there, because what you do is really, you're an influencer in more ways than one, not just maybe on social media, but just some of the things that are happening. People can turn to your product, to your outlet, and get all the information they need upcoming. So set it up for us, what Cookout News does on a regular basis.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And thanks for having me. I hope I can live up to that intro. Cookout News has kind of a unique niche that I don't think was out there. And that's kind of how I founded it. And, you know, I'm the founder of Cookout News, of course. I'll tell you a little bit about what it is. So it seemed like there wasn't really good coverage of business news stuff happening in the industry of outdoor cooking. There was obviously tons on how to cook, how to be great at grilling and barbecue. And then, you know, but beyond that and recipes, it seemed like there wasn't a website you could turn to that gave you happenings on the industry, new products coming out. And so I just decided to start one. We've been going for about 2.5 years now, gained quite a bit of traction. And that's kind of where what we cover, from everything from business news is somebody buying another company down through grill releases, new grill innovations. And I like to say we stop where the food starts. So we don't cover any recipes, food, stuff like that. Some of those other names you mentioned, go to them for that. You'd be better at than me. So that's a little bit about what Cookout News is.
What you do is significant. We've established that. Now let's get into some of the things that you've seen. And I'm going to start. With the last 15 or 20 years. What have you seen? You know, over the course of this, because it's a monstrous industry. I don't know if people really understand how many billions of dollars are in this industry, but what has changed the most in this industry that you've seen?
Yeah, I think the industry is unrecognizable to what it was 15 or 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, and kind of my perspective on it too, I'll give you that. So I was a mechanical engineer a long time ago, worked for Chrysler. That's my background. And then I got into finance, worked in mergers and acquisitions. So mm-hmm. That's kind of my way of looking at things, you know, my purview of what it is. But about 15 to 20 years ago, you had, you know, Weber, you had Charbroil, and that, you know, I feel like there's some smaller names that have always been there, but that was really it. And people just focused on, do you want charcoal or do you want gas? You know, that's, and then obviously you have some smokers, but that's a much smaller market than it is, mm-hmm. than the others. But through the years, you know, you've developed into, now we have griddles. You know, those started, I want to say 2008 is when Blackstone really first came out with their 36 inch, and mm-hmm. those just exploded through COVID. Pellet grills obviously took off. And so then you got this whole technology aspect behind it, you know, with the pellet grills and popularization of that, is that then you see gas grills, charcoal grills, everything starts having tech, where all of a sudden, it's not just about, you know, a charcoal kettle that everyone's familiar with. So it's the same thing, replace it every 5-6 years or whenever you need to. Now there's brand new tech every couple of years that you can have a grill that's outdated. So it's, you have all these different companies apart from just those two big brands I mentioned, mm-hmm. and there's way more options on what you can cook on.
Now you mentioned technology, and clearly we're going to get into some of that in this podcast. Because I think that's a big development. But what has been, like, in terms of the technology, sort of the game changer? And I have one in mind, but I don't want to say it and spoil your moment here. But I will ask you about it. What technology? What's been the best thing to happen in recent years?
Yeah, I think the connection with your phone, or, you know, remote connection to your grill is a big thing. And, you know, when I grew up, obviously, just using, you know, gas grills and charcoal Weber, you know, that was my go-to always. Then I had, you know, I have two little kids, so I could spend a lot less time with my hobby because I can't sit around a grill or a smoker all day. But then once tech started coming into grills and I could monitor, you know, my pellet grill remotely, all of a sudden I had new access to my hobby, and I got to spend a lot more time with it. So to me, that's a huge thing, because it makes it so people can spend less time doing it and still, you know, get the benefit and enjoy it. Mm-hmm. And also it's much more approachable for people, because now people that might be intimidated by grilling or cooking a brisket, all of a sudden they have a step-by-step guide that can walk them through it. So to me, that's the biggest game changer that's happened.
Yeah, that's part of what I was going to say. I was going to be more specific, but I like your answer. Mine is, you know, the probes, the meters and stuff like that. Even if you are, you know, tending to the fire, you have a weekend and you want to spend some time, you know, a lot of us like to mess with the fire and do that whole process. Boy, I use the meter, but I know there's a bunch on the market. That's a game changer, because you can be anywhere and check the temperature, and it's so accurate, et cetera. So that to me was what I was going to say.
Yeah. And I'd agree. That's really leads into the tech, you know, and mm-hmm. I do the same thing. I have a Franklin barbecue pit that, you know, when I have a day to myself and, you know, I have some time, that's what I do. But I still use, you know, temperature probes in there, just because it's just so much easier to monitor your temperatures that way than to go by feel and, you know, and monitor an analog gauge. So that is huge.
What's coming down the pike? Like you don't have to spill any beans in terms of like secrets, but some things maybe you've heard that might even kind of take us to another level.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it seems like with pellet grills, and it's going to be different for each kind of fuel source. Pellet grills are getting more iterative, you know, than from what I've seen last 5 years, they're mm-hmm. making small improvements. You know, on the grill front, less so on smokers, and some people love this, some people hate it. you're going to see major jumps in electric grilling over the next 5 years. That's mm-hmm. that's something that, you know, WC Bradley, which owns Charbroil, they own Pit Boss, they own Current Backyard, they have a whole handful of Oklahoma Joes. They have some pretty big patents that are going to change what it means to be a charcoal grill, and that are going to be a lot closer to gas, I think, within the next few years.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because we are going to get into the pellet grill conversation here in just a moment. But I've seen some stuff myself just sort of piddling around on the internet or on my phone. Like, I've seen some hybrids that are out there, and you can use, whether it's gas or electric or whatever, where it's a grill, it's an old school grill, but it also can be a smoker. I think the hybrids might be something that's happening, right?
Yeah. And you know, there's a company called Brisket that they started out making pellet grills, and they're really big into tech and using AI for it, for cooking. But they actually came out with a grill last spring. I don't even know if you can buy it yet, but they have an electric pellet grill hybrid. So they have a heat element in there that's used for regulating the temperature a lot with your grill. Mm-hmm. And then the pellet grill portion is more for the smoke, but then also they promise to give you a better sear, because you're not just relying on that small fire pot for heat. They also have electric heat within there to make it hotter at the exact same time.
And you know what's funny about this, I understand the other side of this discussion, this argument. A lot of people think like it's sort of quote unquote cheating, or it's too easy, or you're not a purist and all that. I go on the other side. I think it makes a lot more people a lot better pitmaster, and by default, that gets more people into the industry and more people into the game. Let's get your answer to that next, right here on Sports Radio 60 with Wes Wright from Cookout News here on the Bite Me Fishing Show. What do you say, Wes?
To me, it's and you know, I get the comments too about how, even, you know, pellet grills are cheating, or, you know, they don't like electric grills, that's not real grilling, things like that. To me, it's, you know, and what we're all about is just it's a hobby I love. I love, you know, outdoor cooking, so I want it to touch as many people as possible. I want as many people doing it, and somebody that might not do it otherwise, if, you know, they have fun with an electric grill or a pellet grill, I think that's awesome, you know. And maybe someday they have that progression into, you know, an offset or something like that. If they don't, great. I just love that more people are doing it. That encourages companies to release more stuff I like too, so I think it's a fantastic thing.
Now I'm curious. What's your setup look like? I bet you have 17 different grills in your backyard.
Yeah. So we do grill reviews too. So I cycle through a lot of them. I've pared it down to about 12 to 15.
Oh, right, I was now exaggerating, but apparently I wasn't.
Yeah, no. And it'll get out of hand where, you know, my wife can barely back the car out of the garage, 'cause I just have, you know, boxes of grills that need to be put together. And yeah, any type of grill you can think of, I have a version of.
Good. So, okay. Like, you got to make your, boy, this is going to maybe get you in trouble, and I don't mean to. You're going to have 20 people over. You're going to cook a brisket and some chickens. Let's go old school. Easy. What are you pulling out? And what are you saying? All right, this is going to work here.
So I have this kind of, like, you know, two things that I love with barbecue. If I was cooking for a lot of people, if I have time, I love an offset. That's by far my favorite thing to use, is an offset. I like, like the activity of tending to the fire. I think the flavor on that, you know, you can't beat with anything else. It's just, it's a league of its own. I love an offset. When I can't do that though, you know, I have a Traeger pellet grill. I have a Pro 575, which is kind of their standard model that I'd say, you know, they probably sell more of those than any out there. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you know, it'll get you 70% there, but I can do that and not irritate my wife, because I can still help out with getting everything else ready for people coming over.
Yeah, you and me both. If I have the time. And that's the other thing. Like, I do it more now because of the pellet grill. I mean, heck, we, you know, my wife will sometimes have some sort of casserole or something. She goes, you know what? I bet you'll be good with a little smoke flavor. Can you do this on the Traeger? You know, so I'm lighting that thing up 2-3 times a week. But if I have the time, I'm like, all right, now I'm going to have me some fun, you know, kind of what you're talking about with the offset. So, you know, it goes back to what we were just talking about, more people in the game. And oh, by the way, you probably become a much better pitmaster, backyard pitmaster, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it, you know, it shortens that learning curve, because with a pellet grill, if you start on that, you don't need to learn fire management. So the grill takes care of that for you. Whereas prepping the meat and, you know, and trimming it and getting it ready, seasoning it, that's something you can purely focus on and get good at that, and then not have to worry about, okay, now I also have to learn to manage a fire. Cause there's so many variables with barbecue. If you can take some of those out and just really hone in on certain ones, then later you can learn the others. So I think it's awesome.
We're actually going to have Jeremy Andrus, the CEO of Traeger, on the show, I believe the first week of October, if I'm remembering it right. And that is a total game changer. It's a great story. I'm sure you know it, in case our listeners don't. I mean, it was a company that was not flailing, but sort of just stagnant in 1987. And he took it over with no real knowledge, as I understand it, of being, you know, a pit master. I think he said in one interview I saw that his wife was really the one that did the backyard grilling. And then it just boomed. I mean, we all know, you see it at Home Depot and Lowe's and, you know, all these other places and stores. Have you ever seen anything like that? I mean, that it became that big that soon?
Yeah, I consider, they're very different, but Traeger and Blackstone, kind of their story are so similar. And it's funny because they're both based out of Utah, but Traeger became synonymous with pellet grill, right? It's nobody says like, hey, do you have a pellet grill? They say, hey, do you have a Traeger? You know, that's what it means. It's like Kleenex. And yeah, they rocketed so quickly, and it was fueled, you know, through the pandemic too, that it's really in a league of its own. They do it. It's not just that it's, you know, the best pellet grill out there. That's very arguable. It's that their branding's so good, their social media, they focus on it. So they build a community that people want to belong to. It's, you know, if anyone has like a Peloton or something like that, or even Apple products, it has that brand around it that people want to be a part of, which has just fueled their growth.
Yeah, I'm an Android guy, and I catch more hell than anybody on the planet because I'm so loyal. But they're Apple. They are Apple.
Yeah.
Here's the thing about pellet grills, though, and this is what I want you to speak on here. It is all of a sudden, I mean, you can't throw a rock without hitting a quality pellet grill anymore. I mean, you tell me, but I'm thinking there's probably 10 to 15 high-end pellet grills now. Has that become sort of too much competition, or is it a good thing?
I think it's a good, it's not as good for Traeger. It means that they have more work to do to keep growing, you know, how they want, but it's good for the consumer. And I agree, you know, when I test a pellet grill, it's almost to the point where it's like testing a gas grill. There might be little nuances, little features that I like one more than the other, but when you get down to the core function of, does it cook well, they all cook kind of similar, you know, they all do a pretty good job. So I think that's great too, because then somebody that wants to enter in at a lower price point and can't afford a Traeger, they're still going to get a solid product that they can use, you know, without having to pay that premium.
Yeah. Yeah. Where are we? You mentioned the pandemic, and that was something I wanted to get to also. The boat industry and the barbecue industry went off the charts beginning in 2020. I mean, to the point of they were making more money than they were selling more product than they ever had in their lives. Where are we now as an industry, just in general?
Yeah, and I'd add RVing to that list well. Yeah. Anything outdoor related. I think right now, what happened after the pandemic ended, you know, and you had people just wanting to get outside, spending tons of money, then also all the stimulus checks, you know, you could trace those from the time they got to the bank account directly to sales for outdoor companies. Like, you could just watch that spike. Then, so you had that pull ahead of demand. Anyone that wanted to buy a grill in the near future did so during that time, and you had tons of people getting into the market, right? So then you had this huge pull ahead, so you had too much inventory in the system. So all of the big box retailers had way too much inventory, so they stopped buying from the manufacturers for the most part. So you'll notice that in all their earnings have, you know, slowed down dramatically. I think now we've gotten through all that built up supply in the system, and we're getting back to normalcy. The only hang up, though, is you have, you know, And all the companies that they try to forecast how many units they sell and how big they can get, they look at, they start with their addressable market. They start with home sales, right? So they, when you buy a new home, you buy, one of the first things you do is you go out and buy a grill too, right? To go with your new home. No one's buying homes because interest rates are high and they're, you know, really expensive. So there's, you know, the home sales have gone way down. Money is expensive. So also you're not going to finance a grill necessarily for the big ticket purchases. So I think you've worked through all that pandemic buying. Now it's just waiting for the consumer to get back to a more healthy state to get home buying going again. And I think you're going to see an uptick in grill purchases, and it may even be slightly higher, I think, than historical levels, because you're going to have demand from that. And if you look at the replacement cycle, people buy a new grill every 5-6 years, according to data I've seen. So if you bought during the pandemic, there's a good chance you're going to want to buy again in the next couple of years. And when you're coming out of a recession, that's, you know, that's a good time to do it.
Well, all right. Great day here on the Bite Me Fishing Show. Thanks to Mark Nichols. Thanks to Wes Wright. Thanks to the fellas. Don't forget to book Captain Dean, Captain Scott, and Captain Caleb. You'll have a blast. Didn't get to the weather craziness we've had this week and potentially coming up, but I promise we will tomorrow. Let's do it starting at 4 a.m. tomorrow. And thanks to you, of course. You don't want to go anywhere as well. The great Sean Pendergast, Seth Payne, have you covered next. It's Payne and Pendergast right here on Sports Radio 610.